This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Eric Ndello's passion for the Congo runs so deep, you could easily mistake him for a Congolese native who relocated to North Carolina. His parents are actually the immigrants. They came to the States for his dad to attend Shaw University in the 1970s. They moved to Charlotte when Ndello was born and then raised him and his three sisters as Africans in a largely African-American community. As a young kid, Ndello felt a lot of shame about his Congolese roots. Too black for the white kids and too African for the other black kids. But once he got a little older and his father taught him the Ndello family history, that name became a source of pride. So much so that Ndello's streetwear company centers around the Congo. Eric Ndello joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
Take me into your childhood neighborhood and what it was like growing up there in Charlotte.
Well, I grew up in this neighborhood called Roseland here in Charlotte, which would be considered the hood, a project, the ghetto. Largely African-American-based community, but it had some strong pockets of Congolese immigrants and culture, you know, sprinkled around in the community. You know, this is where me and my cousins pretty much grew up. So everybody in the community we looked at as family. So we were tight amongst ourselves, you know, amongst the Congolese community within Roseland. But yeah, it was definitely a predominantly African-American community.
Tell me about, I was going to ask about your parents, and I know they were really intentional in wanting to bring the Congolese cultural influence, and cultural history into your family's lives. Talk to me about that and how they did that.
Yes, well, you know, my parents coming from the Congo, which had been previously colonized by the Portuguese, as well as the most recent situation by the Belgians. They understood the racial plight in the Congo as well as here in the United States. You know, they were very geopolitically conscious. So when they came here, they wanted to make sure that they built a situation for their kids to thrive in this nation, the land of milk and honey, right? So when they came, they made sure that we understood who we are as much as they could. They understood that we were African, that we were different, that we didn't have the same type of background we didn't grow up the same way, you know, and he wanted to make sure that we knew that we were African, understanding exactly the plight that me and my sisters would have to go through growing up, you know what I'm saying, here in the States.
Was there a dissonance between how you perceived yourself and how others perceived you? I mean, growing up with a strong sense of African heritage and African culture, but living in a predominantly African-American neighborhood and going to school, I wonder how much students were able to discern the difference between you and other African-American kids in your neighborhood.
Oh yeah, we were definitely different. I mean, from day one, we knew that there was something different about us. And whether it was our pops telling us, our lineage and where we came from, or it was the community letting us know that you are definitely different. Mm-hmm. You are definitely African. You are definitely less than. You are definitely an African booty scratcher. You are definitely a place where people don't wear clothes. You are definitely from a place where flies just fly on your face and you let them sit there because that's just the way you live. You know, so we're definitely different. And it was a dichotomy, you know what I'm saying? Because on one side, you're hearing inside your house that you're great. And I'm hearing the stories about my grandfather being a senator in the Congo and my uncles being owners of hotels and casinos and churches, you know, and being big businessmen to going out into the streets, into the neighborhood to play with my cousins, only to get picked on every single day, to get beat up every single day. I mean, sometimes looking back at it, it was like we're just being terrorized just because we were African, you know? So it was definitely different, you know? And being in school, you know, especially young kids are brutal, you know? And we come to school and, I mean, I can't even name all the different ways and creative ways that counterparts at the time just let us know that almost like we weren't welcome.
Hmm. And this affected you so much, you really began to kind of hide your heritage as much as you could. And there's a story that really exemplifies this about kind of your name and the name that you wrote on your school papers. Tell me about that and the decision to go by Eric B.
Yes, 100%. Like, being that African was so unpopular, so uncool, to be African was almost like a curse to be African, that I did not want to be African. I wanted to be just like all my African-American friends who had the last name Smith, Johnson, what have you. I wanted to blend in. I wanted not to be different in any shape, form, or fashion, because this difference at that time in my young age was painful. You know, it really touched every part of us, you know, and we didn't understand it. But I remember one particular time I was in the third grade, and I had got a paper back from school, and I got a great mark on it, and I wanted to show my father. So I showed my father the paper, and I might have had 100 on it or whatever, 10 out of 10.
Something good.
You know, yeah, something good, right? Exactly. A+. That's how we roll. But he said, oh, great job, son. But who is this Eric B? So I would not write my last name on my paper, because I was afraid, well, I didn't have any pride in the Ndello last name because it was African-based. So, and at the time, Eric B. and Rakim was a very popular group out in hip-hop at the time. So I identified with Eric B., right? So now you call me Eric B. So on my papers, I'm signing my papers, Eric B. And at that time, they were teaching us cursive. So I had the nice penmanship with the real nice Eric B. written on there, right? And my pops was like, oh, word. Huh, who is this Eric B? And I'm like, Pops, that's me. He's like, no. I named you Eric Bitisu Ndello. I don't know who this Eric B is. And I'm trying to explain to him, and what that explanation only did was leading to a smack across the face.
Mm.
And him telling me, like, listen, no. That is not you. And you need to no longer be ashamed of who you are. This is who you are. But at that time, he's been telling me, it's not like I didn't know, but the pressures, the peers, the taunting, you know, the life outside of the home was stronger than the knowledge, wisdom, and understanding that my father was trying to instill in me. So the world pressure was making me crack to not be who I was and not feel happy in my own skin.
Where did you feel most at home at that time? I know your parents took you to an all-white church growing up. I wonder what that experience was like in the context of all of these other ways you were trying to negotiate your identity.
Right, and that was wild, because now growing up in this all-white church, and my father particularly put us in this all-white church and all-white daycares at the time, because he wanted to make sure that we understood that there was no difference between us and white people.
Hmm.
That there... You can play with them. You're smarter, smart as, or not smarter. You're stronger, not strong as, or not strong. You know, you're compatible. There is no superior, no supremacy, you know what I'm saying, there in just the color of their skin. And he wanted to make sure that that was not an issue, you know what I'm saying, coming up. So being a part of this white church, they treated us like brothers and sisters. They didn't ask us the same questions. They had different questions now. Don't get it twisted. They had different questions, but it weren't the same type of derogatory put down. They weren't asking me questions from a point of, you know, you coming from the bottom. They were asking more questions of, wow, you're from Africa. You know, tell me more about that. You know, I want to go there. Or, you know, of course, they always got the, you know, hair questions and, you know, how do you wash your hair? Why does it feel like that? How can you do all the kind of stuff to it? The magic of the black hair. But outside of that, I felt very comfortable there, you know, and also because they were nicer to me growing up, you know what I'm saying? And all of, and what my dad did as far as having us grow up in an African-American neighborhood, in the hood, going to a white church, only to find out later on in my life that my last name means border. Ndello Nkikongo means border. So I started to understand that all he did was, everybody has to go through their own journey. Everybody has to go through the journey to find out who they are. And each journey is unique. But he instilled in me the different seeds that I could use to put the pieces back together later on in life when it became most important. So now I see myself as a border, as a conduit between both worlds. And with the things that I do now in my life, you know, I see and I know I need, even with the way that the world is going, that we need positive and dope, strong allies and interactions from both sides, from all people, not just black and white, you know what I'm saying, but from all cultures and all people. And that those relationships and those situations that I was in early allowed me to be empathetic and allow me to connect with different people from different cultures and different races, which allowed the whole DRC, Divine Righteous Children, and the guerrilla story to kind of really spread around the world.
Well, that, yeah, I mean, so you're in this place now, and as we mentioned kind of early in this introduction, you have made this big shift over the course of your life to taking a lot more pride and interest and curiosity about your Congolese heritage. But as you look back, I mean, I know it's kind of a nice narrative to name one specific turning point, but are there, you know, a series of turning points where you felt like you became more curious and you wanted to know more? And what was that experience like of trying to really learn more about where you came from?
I mean, easy, simple. Like, I mean, and this is very simple. It might not be that deep, but just when I got to middle school, you know, things started to shift, because now in middle school, like when you play sports, most of the coaches call you by your last name. Right? And it's a very simple thing, but very strong in my life. Now everybody's calling by last name, but you got Smith, and you might see five people turn around. You know, Johnson, five people turn around. You know, whatever, all the other names turn around. But then when they call Ndello, even though they butchered it many times, it was only one person. That was only one person that's going to turn around, and that was me. And that right there really touched me as far as, like, wow, you know, I can see the uniqueness in me. You know, I can see that this name, now it's starting to click a little bit now. You know what I'm saying? Oh, shoot. Ndello, hey, you know what I'm saying? Look, fill in wide receiver. Ndello, fill in, do this, whatever. You know, it felt, you know, like, oh, okay, but that is me. And then it became cool. All my players started calling him Ndello. And then, boom, Ndello became, you know, the name that stood strong. And when you say it properly with the proper Congolese accent, it really instills this pride. You know, Ndello, you know what I'm saying? You got to bring it from the back of your throat, you know what I'm saying, and say it proper. And, you know, that's one of the things that really sparked it at an early age again. But then now, as I transition later on into college, that's when really when it really hit the fan, really, for me, when now I'm amongst other like-minded individuals who come from other places, other African countries, other, you know, international places, you know, and, you know, people who had different experiences, who grew up in bigger towns, you know, who dealt with different cultures of people at all times. And now it just became like, oh, wow, this is who I am, you know. But then I also became like a representative of, as I became more prideful in who I was in my last name and being Congolese, then I started to learn more about the culture, and that energy then started attracting more like-minded people around me, to the point where we just created different organizations, one particularly called KWU at NC State, that was sole purpose was to spread knowledge, wisdom, and understanding of the Pan-African diaspora and to connect us all as human beings.
I want to talk more about college in a second, but I want to learn a little bit more about the convenience store that your family owned and ran. Yeah. and the experience of growing up in that shop and what that was like for you.
I mean, that was amazing. That at 10 years old, I mean, I grew up in a traditional African family. Like 10 years old, I'm working, you know. So when my pop started the store at 10 years old, I was in the shop. I mean, I remember being in there nights at 3 a.m. by myself. Selling, you know, selling all kinds of stuff, you know, saying in the store. And that taught me how to run business. You know, it taught me how to exchange money, how to negotiate, you know. And in that neighborhood that we were in, which is currently called NODA, North Davidson, which is now a gentrified neighborhood, which used to be the hood back in the day as well. But now, well, in that process, there was a lot of different crackheads and different, you know, people of all walks of life, that at 10 years old, I had to act like I was 18 years old and be illegal to sell beer to these people. So I was doing all these older things, you know, at such a young age, and even driving at 12. Like, I was driving to the store, opening and closing the store you know, at 12 years old.
Uh-oh.
You know? So that caught me. I know certain things you probably shouldn't say, but these are things that actually go down.
You ended up taking over the store for a little bit in college. Tell me about what led to that moment.
Yeah, so we ran the store for 10 years. And one day in fall break 1998, I come home from college, NC State. And normally the routine is I catch a train back from NC State, go uptown to this train station, call my pops at the store in Noda, which is about 5 minutes away from uptown, the station. He'll come pick me up. I'll relieve him at the store. He'll go live life. This one particular time I called and nobody answered the phone. So I ended up catching a cab to the store, and I get to the store and the store is closed. Everything was weird, you know. Called my pops, or called my sister, and nobody was answering the phone. Got a contact with my homeboy, and he let me know that my pops was in the hospital. And this is when I found out my pops had cancer. And that was in December. And every time I talk about it, it's emotional.
I mean, that's so sudden to come home expecting to be reunited with him and to find out in that moment that he has a serious illness. I can imagine that's so
exactly
shocking.
And they tried to keep it from me for such a long time because they knew what I was going to do. They knew that I was going to step up and leave my dreams and my vision to sacrifice for the family, which is what the oldest male is supposed to do. So that's exactly what I did anyway. So didn't go to school the next semester, stayed home, ran the store, had other jobs to help maintain financial situations at the house. We had to bury our pops and all the other financial things that come with all that kind of good stuff. And it was it played a very big toll on the family. But I remember one specific thing that also touched me in that time period was when my mom saw how hard I was working and saw that I was really going to change the trajectory of my life and really just focus on home. She said to me that, Dello, this is your father's dream. Live your dream. And that really, really touched me. And it changed everything for me. Because at that time, right after that, I ended up selling the store to one of my Haitian brothers named Ron, who ended up selling the store to another Congolese brother, who was my dad's friend. So it came back into the family anyway, which is kind of cool. You know, but we definitely sold the store. And I went back to school. And that's when the other phase of my life started.
Well, we're going to talk all about the other phase of your life when we come back from a break. I am speaking with Eric Ndello, the master screen printer at McFly Fresh Printing and co-founder of DRC Apparel. Just ahead, we'll hear what he did in college and how it led him to his fashion business and working in sustainability and fashion activism. All of that today on The State of Things. Stay with us just ahead. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. After his father's passing in 1999, Eric Ndello's mother encouraged him to find a new path in life. That led him to start two businesses, the streetwear brand DRC Ape Apparel and the screen printing company McFly Fresh Printing. The two companies are now some of Charlotte's most beloved local creative ventures, and they even have some global reach. Ndello is still with me now. So we ended really at that turning point, your mom says. Pursue your own dream. Go back to school and pursue your own dream. So how did you find that dream?
Well, it was wild because right after that, the dream, I also remember that my father had told me, like, before he passed away, I had sat down with him in the living room, and I was like, Pops, what should I do right now? And he told me, you know exactly what to do. And I was like, what about this engineering vibe? You know, he was like, I didn't tell you to be an engineer. You said you wanted to be an engineer. So, and I just held you to it. And I was like, interesting. Okay, work. So after that, I went back after he passed. I went back to school. So I took a semester off, went back to school. And I thought my dream was to be an engineer because that's what I really wanted to do. Went back and got straight D's right across. The first time in my life I've ever made a D, let alone straight D's all the way across. But from there, I had another decision to make. And I was like, wow, do I really want to do this? I mean, it's mad hard, you know, and do I really still have a passion to be an electrical engineer? So at that time, before I sat out this semester, I remember getting a letter from the school offering a national student exchange program. And I had got that, and I also received an opportunity to do a co-op at NASA at the same time. So now, right after I made all my D's, I was able to get that semester dropped, thank goodness, due to hardship. But right after that, I had the opportunity to go to Florida to go be an intern in that, a co-op at NASA, which would have set my life in this direction, or go to California in the National Student Exchange Program and learn how to do digital media and videography and digital design. I chose digital design, videography, and ended up in California. And that kind of set the creative flow of everything that came right after that.
So when did you first become interested in fashion?
Fashion, really, in 1997, really. Like, in 1997, when my cousin and I are at my dad's store, when everything was all good, and Zaire became the Democratic Republic of Congo. On that day, when we heard it on the radio, we said, we are going to start a clothing company called DRC. And at that time, we were young, and we were like, the DRC is going to stand for Dirty Rotten Congolese. But we further evolved and changed it to Divine Righteous Children.
That's a big evolution. So you're young. You come up with this idea for this fashion company. You get into digital media. You spend some time in the corporate world. And eventually you decide you really need to fully lean in to fashion and your creative work. How did you make that final leap?
Well, it was a series of things. One, I had the opportunity to go to Goma to teach a screen printing course with my brother and sister, Shetty and Pet Ndaloko.
And Goma's in the eastern part of the DRC?
Yes, in the eastern part of DRC. Actually, if you look up Goma, you will see that Goma at one point in time was the red capital of the world. It's the source of where all the coltan that runs all of the cell phones and all the electronics that we see in the world right now, 80% of it comes from the Congo. So it's pretty much like Wakanda, that area of the Congo right now. And I went there to teach this screen printing course, against the will of everybody around me, most people around me who was like, wow, it's too crazy to go out there. But when I got there, it was an amazing experience. But I got a chance to teach 15 youth the art of screen printing business and how to start their brand. And that helped me find my passion. Something that I could do without getting paid for, but will continue to do for the rest of my life. I found it right there. And when I came back to corporate America, it was just, I came back in August. By December, I was gone. Yeah. And by March, I had my equipment delivered to the house, and I set up my garage screen printing outfit. And that was all in 2015. And that was in 2015. I went to Congo in 2014. And by March 2015, I had the equipment and the producing my own T-shirts, screen printed T-shirts at the time started. I had already been doing heat press and outsourcing a lot of my designs to different screen printers since 2004. But in 2015, and that experience with going to Goma and being able to be on the ground of the Congo, my homeland, and be able to teach these skills to the next generation. And then to see how they received these skills and also taught me that I needed to be going back to Congo and Africa and creating this cycle of knowledge, the circle of knowledge, the circle of commerce as well, and the circle of culture, and packaging that in a way that the world could see the beauty of the Congo. So we already knew with DRC that we wanted to show the good parts and the amazing things that we know about Africa, even though media and everything else tried to show the negative side. We wanted to focus on the positive side. But going to Goma allowed me to be there firsthand and then now take our company to the next level.
I see some really clear threads from, your youth and getting to know the history of where you came from and developing pride in it and wanting to make that connection? Obviously, your engineering background and having the skill set that would enable you to learn about screen printing. But I'm curious about this artistic sensibility, because you have to have an eye and a vision and a design sense to start a fashion company. So how did you develop your own artistic sensibility?
And that's beautiful you said that, because I started out as an artist. Before I became an engineer and got into this technical stuff, I was an artist. I used to win awards in middle school, you know, but in our community, you know, African community, being an artist just wasn't really a viable career to go on. Like, you got to be a doctor, lawyer, engineer, something that's going to bring bread to the table, right? So I didn't really focus on it. Like, I was good at it, but I didn't really focus on it, so I put it down to the side. So it was always in me. But really, my cousin Rod, Roger Sakala, who's also a partner in DRC, who was there when we started the company, he is a fashion expert. Like, that's what he does. Like, and plus, being that with in Congo, there's a sector of people called the Sappers. Now, and LASAP. And LASAP is a fashion movement that basically takes fashion, colonial fashion, and flips it into an African way that adds ownership and identity, you know what I'm saying, that kind of talks about all the plights and all the different struggles of colonialism in Africa through fashion. So when I saw that movement of the Sappers, and I got a chance to meet the Sappers when we were invited to Kinshasa Fashion Week in 2015, that also set another set for us, because this is Congolese are known for two main things, even though we're great on many things, but we're known for our fashion and we're known for our music. You know, so I wanted to take those two things, and fashion and music, you know, are brother and sister. They're married together, you know what I'm saying? It's a perfect combination. So we use fashion and music along with my cousins. They also had a music group called Brazen at the time. And they helped us change our name from DRC Clothing Company to DRC 8 Peril when they created the song 8 Peril for us. So it's all kind of all married, you know, all in together and based around culture, fashion, art, design, and music.
And there's so many interesting kind of power dynamics to negotiate for you, I can imagine, you know, as someone who has Congolese heritage but has lived in the United States and then is going back to the Congo to learn but also to share and also to get inspiration for the fashion that you create, and then you're selling products. And so how do you kind of navigate all of those in a way that doesn't replicate any or tries not to replicate any of the harm that has been created from these patterns of commerce and capitalism and cultural appropriation? How do you do it differently when you are setting out and when you're running these businesses?
I mean, you really have to be intentional. Like it's cool to be conscious was our first tagline of our brand. So in order to be conscious, well, being conscious, we knew about all those different things and how people were getting exploited and how the fashion industry was definitely one of the most wasteful industries in the world. And, you know, how fast fashion started to take over the market to where now nothing is sustainable. And everybody is just taking clothes, wearing them a couple of times and throwing them to the landfills. And then somehow they're ending back up in poor countries, like in Africa and Asia and all the in Latin America. So, you know, for us, we consciously wanted to make sure that everybody from the bottom all the way up to the top in our supply chain was taken care of properly, and that the products that we used, to whatever degree we could control, were actually sustainable and sustainable products. And we in our company here, we want to decrease our carbon footprint as much as we can and try to encourage other companies to do the same, because it is still profitable, even though, because you go buy a recycled shirt or a shirt that's made out of organic cotton or hemp fibers, what have you, it costs so much to make and they put so much price on those things that it's hard for small companies to actually get into that game and still be able to sell their product at a reasonable price that their customer can afford, right? So you have to find other ways that you can still make your process as clean as possible, and at the same time make sure your workers and everybody in your supply chain they're taken care of fairly. So it is a big deal. And we try to do that same thing with our suppliers here, as well as with the suppliers and the seamstresses and artisans we work with in the Congo. But it is a big task to take on. But it feels good at the end of the day knowing that no one in the supply chain, in your vertically integrated company, feels like they're being taken advantage of. And that also makes them want to work for you even more because they know that outside of your company, there are people getting treated in the ways that they don't want to get treated. So it's very important for us, you know, and we want to be a model for that. So you can be cool, right? And you can be conscious at the same time.
I'd love to end on your reflections kind of in this very particular moment that we are in right now. I mean, given all of the various ways that you've negotiated borders throughout your life, and now you are a business owner in Charlotte working in the middle of a pandemic to try to keep your business afloat while there is yet another reckoning about racial injustice in this country. I mean, what insight do you have into this moment about border negotiation right now? I know that's a big question, but.
Border negotiation?
Yeah.
Explain for me exactly.
Like how you are navigating the intersection of the borders in your own life, being of African heritage, seeing this Black Lives Matter movement, being a business owner in the midst of all of these disparities. It seems like there's a lot of borders you're kind of transcending navigating.
There are a lot of borders. There are, you know, and we have a design that we have out called Fly Immigrants. My family are immigrants. Immigrants make the world fly. We flock and fly all the different places and come and add culture and goodness. So if we're dealing with the border here in this country here, like, I mean, it's a lot. It's a very political, and I'm not a politician at all, and I don't really get too deep in politics, but what I feel is that, you know, how we look and deal with people means a lot. I mean, a lot of the rhetoric around immigrants is wild for me because of the fact that a lot of people who speak on that were immigrants in this country too as well, are immigrants in this country too as well in their history. You know what I'm saying? So being able to go back and forth between borders, you know, and be able to deal with people justly, I mean, that's human life, I feel like. That is human life, to be able to come and intersect between people, culture, taste, foods. If it wasn't so much integration and the fact of culture, you know, then, and these borders kind of blending in with each other, then the world would be a very, very bland place.
How does a Black Lives Matter movement message resonate with you?
Very strongly, because I am a Black man, and I've been through many situations in life where they could have went to the left, and I'm grateful of where I am, you know, that I'm here, because I've had guns pointed at me by cops. You know, I've been unjustly searched, and I've been pulled over for BS reasons, you know, and I want to make sure that we, just like I wanted to be treated fairly as a Congolese individual in my African-American community, I want us to be treated as humans equally in this American and world society. Because that's all we are. There's no difference between in our skin color. But the more we work together and the more we collaborate, the better I feel this world becomes. We have to be seen as the people who we are. We are great. We are wonderful. And we just want to show that to the world. Whenever we grow and we build, sometimes our greatnesses are torn down. And why is that? Our lives matter. We are equal. We built this country, you know, and we want to share with it equally as everyone else. Our agenda is not to destroy. Our agenda is to build. And as I feel as a Black man, as a Congolese man, as a world citizen, I feel like we need to be building together to lead a better example for our generations and to leave a great generation in front of us. Because the more that we're separate, the more that we divide, the more that we destroy. And we're trying to build here.
Eric Ndello is a creative director and master screen printer at McFly Fresh Printing and a co-founder of DRC Apparel. Eric, thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You can find out more about him and his businesses at our website, stateofthings.org. I'm Anita Rao.